arrival was almost unspeakable.
We brought all evil in some form or another.
I'm not guilty.
The dead won't bother me. It's the living you gotta worry about.
If I couldn't keep them there with me whole, at least I felt that I could keep their skeletons.
Hello, and welcome to the Bad Taste Crime Podcast. I'm Vicky.
And I am Janelle.
We're back again with another episode this week. We are coming off some really fun stuff. We just did our live show in Elgin, which may or may not be up at some point.
We'll see what happens. You didn't lose the thing, did you?
No, not yet. I was just over at Tips yesterday. And I was like, oh, I meant to bring the episode. It was recorded on a single SD card that is the only copy in existence is on this SD card. And was entrusted with it. And I wanted to take it with me to Tips yesterday so that I could shift the responsibility to her. And she was like, no. She's like, I don't want that. But I left it here. I still have it though. So that'll be coming to you guys in the next couple of weeks. But in the meantime, we have a great episode for you. How are you doing, Janelle?
You know, I'm breathing. And that's about all I can say.
Is that the only silver lining right now? Is that you are physically still breathing?
Yes. You know, if you have ever been in grad school, you know how dumb, crazy busy you are. But on top of that, being an artist in grad school, you have to do shows. So I'm working on an installation for a biennial. I'm working on 100 papers that I have to write.
So all the normal stuff.
No, I don't sleep and I have miniature heart attacks daily.
So fun. Well, I'm glad that you are with us today. It wouldn't be the same without you.
In fact, took some ashwagandha before this, so
I don't know what that is. But
it's
sure.
a wonderful herb that helps you with your mood stability, and it helps you sleep too if you take a slightly higher dose as well. But yeah, it's ashwagandha and St. John's wort are herbs that will help with anxiety and depression. They're calming, just like chamomile and lavender.
I know another herb that's pretty calming.
Oh, no, not for me.
The best kind of herb.
Weed makes me anxious.
Yeah, it's not for everybody. No. Anyway, that's not what the show's about. This show is about crime, which we're going to get to. But first, let's head over to the newsroom. This week, our story comes from Moscow, Russia, where a woman is incredibly upset with her ex-husband. I don't know if you saw this or not, but I was like, it was definitely like an only in Russia kind of a moment, for sure. So 59-year-old Valeria Yudilova broke into the cryogenics lab of her ex-husband, 41-year-old Danila Medvedev.
Sure.
There, she drained the liquid nitrogen from giant Dewar flasks that contained both frozen bodies and detached brains of people who had hoped to be resurrected in the future, loaded them onto trucks, and then left.
Okay.
Yep. Police were called. They managed to stop the truck carrying the remains, but they were unable to catch Valeria herself, who managed to leave with someone's brains. It was also reported that the bodies were from both people from Britain and from the U.S.
Okay.
And that's the story.
Did she say why? No.
The article that I was reading that... So it's an article from The Sun that... It didn't really specify like why she was so upset, just that she was. It's like, fuck you, I'm gonna take these frozen brains and leave.
I wonder if he was like, if you know, like some sort of backhanded statement to her about how she's not smart and didn't have a brain.
Oh my God.
If this is going to be like, oh, I don't have a brain, do I? Yeah. Here's all these brains.
I'll show you who doesn't have a brain. You, now that I took it. Oh my gosh, yeah. So I guess the moral of the story is, if you own a cryogenics lab, don't piss off your partner. I don't know.
Cue the music the Scarecrow sang in The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah. If I only had a brain.
Right.
All right. We'll move right along to Netflix and Kill, which this week is an Amazon Prime and Kill, because I would be remiss if we did not
Amazon
talk about...
Burgers? No.
Yeah. If we didn't talk about LuLaRich.
Oh.
Have you watched this yet?
I have not.
Okay.
Vicky, oh, sweet Vicky, I wish I could watch things. Right now, well, I'm not watching anything.
I'll be honest with you. So this came out just like, I think like a week before we're recording this episode, and it has become the talk of the internet. And I did go out of my way to like watch this for our episode today, because mm-hmm. I was like, we have to talk about it while it's still blowing up. So are you familiar with the clothing company LuLaRoe?
Yes, I hate it.
Yeah. So
for the record.
Yes. So LuLaRich chronicles the rise and sort of fall of multi-level marketing company LuLaRoe in this four-part documentary series. The documentary includes interviews with many past and current retailers, as well as owners and founders Mark and Deanne Stidham. Within 4 years of being in operation, the company had more than $1 billion in sales and 80,000 consultants, which, if you know anything about multi-level marketing or pyramid schemes, you would know that this is not a sustainable business model, especially when you get to that many consultants.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, now in 2021, LuLaRoe has been subject to many civil lawsuits, including a 2017 class action that alleged the company's proprietary software was calculating incorrect sales tax. Another 2017 $1 billion class action in California alleging LuLaRoe is a pyramid scheme. 2018,
you don't say.
Right. A 2018 suit from clothing supplier Providence Industries for $49 million claiming LuLaRoe was insolvent and was behind on payments, but also that there's like all of these shell companies that LuLaRoe is funneling all of this money into. The impression that I got is like the money started getting funneled into these, like all of these LLCs, when the Stidhams sort of got whiff that there were going to be a bunch of lawsuits coming. Hide the money, right?
Yeah, right. Classic.
There is also a 2019 suit from the state of Washington, which is probably the biggest one to date. It alleged that the company is a pyramid scheme. This suit was settled in February of 2021 for $4.74 million, although the company was able to deny any wrongdoing, as you so often do with the settlement with large companies.
Mm-hmm.
It is a great documentary, first of all, because Deanne and Mark are very interesting people. I mean, they're kind of, I think when we think about people who start these kind of multi-level marketing companies, like they definitely fit that sort of like standard in your head, where they are always talking about how we started this company because we wanted to help women empower themselves and all of these stay-at-home moms to like work mm-hmm. and bring in all this money and blah, 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 blah. But I almost wonder if like they came on, because they were like fully involved in this documentary, that I wonder if they came on thinking we're going to be able to tell our stories and like exonerate ourselves in a way, mm-hmm. you know, and it.
Yeah.
Honestly, which is, was not a good look.
Yeah. Which is, I mean, that sometimes happens with documentarians. They don't really give off the entire story of why they want to do this. And then it mm-hmm. kind of leads to misleading the people that they are, you know, interviewing. So that's not yeah. ethical, by the way, guys. So don't do that.
Yeah. Although I will say, I don't think there's anything wrong when you're making a documentary like this to say, we are looking at the history of LuLaRoe as a company and looking at some of these larger questions of why everything went wrong. Because in this case, there is a lot of issues with the company as far as product becoming defective over time, the return policy for the product changing, and therefore putting like thousands of women in debt. The structure of the company, how women are making their money, the way that leadership is treated and how they're told to like train and onboard people. I mean, there's like a lot of really sketchy shit, right? So yeah. I don't think there's anything wrong with being like, we're just going to tell the story of your company when everybody knows the story of that company is like bullshit, right? I don't know. Part of me is like, I'm sure they were fully aware of what was happening. And they're like, we'll talk because we know we'll be able to exonerate ourselves. But like,
yeah,
that's not
how that great. Works.
No. There's also a lot of this idea of like pushing the wrong ideals for what a woman is. You know, you always have to be pretty and made up, subservient to your husband. The owners, Mark and Deanne, are Mormon. So there is sort of these like Mormon undertones of, you know, female subservience and working for your husband and doing all of the things that he asks and stepping aside when the time is right type of a thing. All bullshit. Anyway. Worth a watch. When you get a moment, I think you should watch it because it's pretty short, but it's like, oh my God, it's really interesting. Because I knew a lot of people were selling LuLaRoe, so.
Oh yeah. It's like every person we ever went to high school with comes out of the woodwork. They friend you on Facebook and they're like, look at this. I do tummy tea. Look at, I exercise weekly with tummy tea. And I'm like, girl.
Yeah.
Shut the fuck up. You ain't never been fat, so stop. Right.
I cannot tell you how many people that we went to high school with does that and like the it works bullshit and
it's a lot of exercise and clothing related shenanigans. And I'm like, do you remember what I looked like and what I was all about in high school? I'm not buying your fucking leggings, okay?
Right.
Have I ever worn them? No.
Now, I will say, full disclosure, I do own two pieces from LuLaRoe.
How dare you?
That I bought when the company was really getting big. Somebody had an at-home party. They were really cute. One of them I still wear. It was before the like the diminishing quality of the garments, I would say. But I have since not bought anything further because, to be quite frank, it was really fucking expensive.
Yeah.
For something very basic. It was like, eh, no thanks. Anyway, we're going to move along. This is that part of the show where we say content may not be appropriate for all listeners. We will be talking about some murder.
Oh, really?
Child death and some pretty, pretty nasty things. So heads up on that. But today, are you ready?
I mean, yes.
We are talking about familicide.
Woo-woo!
We've talked about familicide before. It's been a little while. Also known as the family annihilator. But I feel like for some reason, I've been seeing a lot of news about cases of familicide that have happened within the last like 1 to 2 years. I don't know if that is like any correlation with just like people spending more time with their family being in quarantine or.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's the only thing that I can think of that has changed from the last time that we covered this to now.
I mean, we're just the general upset with people having parents. I mean, that's how I feel.
Yeah.
No, there is a lot. There is a lot, and it's a lot of, I noticed a lot more men.
Yes.
Being involved. Usually, like, when we grew up in the 90s, it was a lot of women taking out their families, or specifically their children. So it's definitely, I don't know, it's strange. If you listen to the last podcast on the left, they do a lot of jokes when they talk about male serial killers who kill their families, about how they have to hold the line, they have to be the man in the relationship, and they do it in a joking way, but I really feel like there's truth in that. Like, there's a lot of people who grew up with anxiety, and as an adult, they don't know how to cope, and so they just lose their goddamn mind.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds about right. So we are going to start with a story from New Zealand.
Nice. And
this is about the Lundy murders.
Ooh.
So this New Zealand family consisted of 38-year-old Christine Marie Lundy, her husband, 43-year-old Mark Edward Lundy, and their 7-year-old daughter, Amber Grace Lundy. Now, Christine was involved in many community activities, including their local Girl Guides, which is like Girl Scouts.
Mm-hmm.
Christine and Mark owned a kitchen sink business, and in 1999, Mark also purchased a vineyard in Hawke's Bay. The family, by all accounts, was filled with love and caring, and there didn't really appear to be any signs that the family was in turmoil. That is, until Christine and Amber were found dead. Now, on August 30th, 2000, a number of people attempted to call the Lundy home. After several unanswered attempts, concerned family members decided to go to the house and make sure everything was okay. James Wiggery, who is Christine's brother, decided to knock on the door, and when he didn't get an answer, he broke into the house to see what was going on. There, he discovered Amber's body face down with a brutal head wound in the doorway of her parents' bedroom. At that point, James called emergency services immediately, and it was only after he called emergency services that he noticed Christine's body face up on her bed with multiple injuries to her face and arms. The entire scene was coated in blood, including the walls and floors. Mark Lundy was not in the area at the time of the discovery, and by the time that he returned home, police had the entire scene blacked off. So this is the start to what is going to become kind of a weird little story. So Mark wasn't at the house when all of this happened. He had actually been out of town on business and had spent the night at the Foreshore Motor Lodge in Wellington. It was he who got in touch with his brother-in-law, James, to go and check on the family after he had failed to get a hold of them on the phone. Now, according to the case that the Crown would later present, Mark had driven to Wellington for business. He then checked into a hotel around 5 p.m. and received a call from his wife and daughter. He was told at that time that the two were heading to McDonald's for dinner, and they also found that there were two other calls made from his cell phone, one to a business partner at Hawke's Bay and the second to an escort service in Patone around 11 p.m., Now, at this point in like the initial investigation, Mark appeared to have an airtight alibi and wasn't in town on the night of the murders. But upon further investigation, police did find a receipt for the McDonald's trip that the Lundy said they were going to take. They found this receipt at the Lundy home, and they discovered that Christine had placed a phone call to a friend around 7 p.m. So they were still alive at 7 p.m. Mm-hmm. There were also reports of a suspicious jogger in the area at approximately 7:20 p.m. that evening, and they also found that the family computer in the home had been switched off at 10:52 p.m. Authorities were also able to determine that Christine and Amber had been bludgeoned to death with a tomahawk-like weapon or a small axe. The bodies were collected and taken in for an autopsy and then subsequently released to the family on September 7th, 2000 for funeral proceedings. During the funeral, which was somewhat televised in New Zealand, Mark was seen collapsing from grief as he left the church. I definitely get very much like there's been other cases where they televise a funeral and the parents are showing some really strange behavior.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of the one, and I'm trying to remember the woman's name, who was like, they were like spraying silly string on the grave and like blowing bubbles and stuff. And it was her son.
I remember the images, but yeah, I don't remember which case that was.
Yeah. It's definitely giving me like those kind of vibes, sort of. Like it was just overly dramatic.
Yeah.
One of the more damning descriptions of his actions at the funeral comes from Mike White with stuff.co.nz. Quote, and remember him at Christine and Amber's funeral, all wailing and collapsing, overplayed grief in dark suit and glasses. That's how it was seen by the public, and for 20 years, that's the lens through which we've considered Mark Lundy and his claims he didn't murder his wife and daughter. Mark Lundy, the bad acting ham and bumbling fool who was a vile scheming killer, a figure of ridicule yet a totem of evil. Mark Lundy, a caricature of the gauche and grisly, at once laughable yet malevolent. End quote.
Wowzers.
Right. Some real colorful language in there. Mm-hmm. And I would say, like, this is how much of the public saw it at the time, was like, okay, like, overly grieving can also be suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see what you think of it when the rest of the evidence piles up. So police investigated the murders for a full 6 months before finally arresting Mark Lundy for the murders of his wife and daughters. Once this case began working its way through the court system is when things get really interesting. And this is actually the piece that really drew me to this case. One, because I find, like, the way court systems in other countries work very interesting, because a lot of times they're pretty different to our own. But also because this whole thing is a little sketchy. So during Mark's initial trial, the prosecution laid out its version of events. So I'm going to tell you all this, and then I want to know what you think about all of this evidence that the Crown brought up.
Okay.
So the Crown's initial version of events alleged that Mark had murdered Christine and Amber for the insurance payout. Just days before the murders, the life insurance policies had been increased from $200,000 to $500,000. This was followed up with evidence that the Lundy's kitchen sink business was failing and slowly moving into debt. Thanks to undigested McDonald's french fries that were found in Amber's stomach, the Crown also alleged that the time of death was around 7 p.m. and that Mark had driven back to the house from the hotel, murdered his wife and child, and then drove back to the hotel where the phone calls were later placed from. They also found a shirt inside Mark's luggage that had... It was like the shirt itself was inside out and had been packed in the luggage. Christine's DNA was later found on the shirt, and prosecutors alleged that it had been worn the night of the murders. For the trial, they reached out to pathologist Dr. Rodney Miller, who was from Dallas, Texas, who worked specifically with immunohistochemistry, or IHC. Dr. Miller took a mucus-like small stain from the shirt, tested it, and determined the stain tested positive for brain or spinal cord tissue from Christine. This seemed to be the strongest evidence, as there was no other physical evidence tying Mark to the crime, and the murder weapon was never found. So, thoughts on what the Crown was presenting?
It doesn't, I mean, that's just like a lot of science-y jargon, and it, I don't know, it doesn't seem like it really ties him to much.
Yes.
And that whole digested food thing, it was just giving me JonBenet Ramsey like flashbacks.
Right. Right. And it does give you an idea of when the murders happened, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it is totally like that kind of JonBenet vibe.
Yeah.
So there are some really obvious glaring problems with this case. So we're going to start with this idea that Mark was driving back and forth from the hotel to the house and then back to the hotel. So the timeline is said to have worked out like this. Mark spoke to Christine by phone at 5:43 p.m. He was in Patone and she was in Palmerston North, which is approximately 140 kilometers or around 87 miles away. He then drove to Palmerston North, murdered his wife and child, hid all of the evidence, manually changed the clock on the computer so that it appeared to have been turned off later, changed his clothes, put on a wig, and then drove back to Patone by 8:28 p.m. So between basically 5:45 and 8:30, they're saying this is all of this driving back and forth, the murders, the cleanup, everything happened in that, it's like 2, maybe 3 hour-ish period.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. You'd have to be driving kind of fast to just make it there and back.
Yeah.
And I believe in one of the articles I read, they said something like he was going to have to be driving 72 kilometers an hour there and 75 kilometers an hour back.
Mm-hmm.
Which is
pulled the fuck over.
Right.
Hopefully.
Right. So following him getting back to Patone, according to the Crown, he then continued to make calls to his business partner and a sex worker when he returned that evening. Now, a private investigator attempted to replicate this trip in 2004 and claimed it was impossible. The second big issue actually arises from the life insurance policies. Mm-hmm. So when Mark had signed up for the increase in coverage, his agent at the time informed the family that the policy wouldn't go into effect until the policy documents were sent out, which was going to take a couple of days. The murders occurred only 4 days after the paperwork had been signed and the policy documents had not arrived at the house yet. And so the defense argued that Mark couldn't have been aware whether or not the policy was in effect at the time of the murders, and sort of dismissed this as the reason for motive. And indeed, the policy hadn't gone into effect at the time the murders were committed, the new policy. Finally, the biggest piece of evidence, which is the DNA, has some of the biggest flaws. And I'm sure you all, if you've listened to this show before, know how we feel about junk science.
Yes.
This definitely lands in the junk science realm, I would say. So, of course, as someone who is neither a scientist or a medical professional, I had no idea about this particular, like, IHC testing.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll learn a little bit about it. So before prosecutors contacted Dr. Miller from Dallas, Texas, they actually reached out to another neuropathologist based in New Zealand, Dr. Hang Teo. So this is what D Magazine had to say about Dr. Teo's thoughts on the sample. Quote, Teo was not confident about the sample and told the detective that the cells had degenerated badly, such that he did not want to give testimony in the court. When he looked at the slide, he commented that he did not think Mark Lundy should be convicted of the murder on the strength of the cells, end quote. It's also worth saying that IHC has been criticized by the FDA as being subjective and variable because it is highly reliant on methodology. And up until Dr. Miller used the IHC testing for Mark Lundy, it had never been used for that purpose before. So this is the first time. During the trial, there was also these questions of the cleanliness of the lab where the sample was tested, as well as the possibility that the samples may have been contaminated, because this whole time they had been stored in paper envelopes, stored and transported in paper envelopes.
Highly reliable.
Instead of like plastic sealed bags, like sterile plastic sealed bags. What the fuck? Even like when they brought them over from New Zealand into the US, they were put into paper bags and physically flown on a plane over.
You know how we are with kits and testing and things, so it's not much different other places.
It's like, what the fuck, guys? Even if you don't have a scientific background, like, I feel like it's pretty obvious that a paper envelope is going to let all sorts of contaminants and things in. Like, it's not sealable, really.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. So Mark himself took the stand, something rarely, if ever, recommended.
Yes. Do not do it.
And honestly, like, as you probably would have expected, it did not help his case, really, at all. Mark changed his accounts of events multiple times and then disputed evidence provided by his own brother. The defense did attempt to dispute the brain tissue evidence by pointing out that there was blood and tissue splattered everywhere, including the walls, bed, and floor around the bodies. But his car, glasses, wedding ring, and other shoes and other clothes were all tested for blood and tissue, and none was ever found. The jury deliberated for 7 hours before returning a guilty verdict, sentencing Mark to a minimum non-parole period of 17 years. So, of course, Mark appealed this decision, which was rejected, and his original non-parole period was increased from 17 to 20 years, which would have made him eligible for parole in 2022. Now, in 2013, the case was brought before the UK Privy Council, which is like a really interesting little judicial body that I have never heard of. So, and this, I'll tell you what, a lot of this goes all the way back to like colonialism and all of these mm-hmm. British owned things. So since the original trial took place in New Zealand prior to the establishment of the New Zealand Supreme Court, which wasn't established until 2004, which I also find a little crazy.
Yeah.
The case was eligible to be brought before the Privy Council. Now, the Privy Council is made up of mainly justices from the UK Supreme Court and senior judges from the Commonwealth. And this is from Wikipedia, admittedly, quote, "The Privy Council formerly acted as the High Court of Appeal for the entire British Empire other than the UK itself. It continues to hear judicial appeals from some other independent Commonwealth countries, as well as Crown dependencies and British overseas territories." That's how it ended up there. Citing doubt over the methods used during the brain matter testing and new evidence that had been presented to the council, they vacated the sentence and remanded the case down to the lower courts for retrial. As for Dr. Miller, our lovely brain tissue, quote-unquote, expert, he continues to claim his testing is completely accurate, saying, quote, "I can say with 100% certainty that the tissue on Mr. Lundy's shirt was central nervous system tissue. Not 99.999% certainty, 100%, end quote.
No, sir. That's not how science works. It's not at all how science works.
But Janelle, he's 100%
no,
certain.
No, even if you really do think that, no. You test, and it's never 100% accuracy, ever.
Oh my God, yeah. So the retrial took place in 2015, and the Crown, by this point, had made significant changes to his case. So now they were saying that Mark didn't murder Christine and Amber in the 3-hour window, but instead drove home in the middle of the night after he had already been with the sex worker to murder his wife and daughter. Which is weird because it completely disregards this evidence of undigested food.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's fine, I guess. We'll just ignore that evidence, and the rest of it just falls into place, I guess. They again claimed that they had the tissue sample found on Mark's shirt tested again by Dr. Letitia in the Netherlands. Again, the tests were developed specifically for this case and have not been used before or since. Sounds legit. This time, the jury deliberated for 16 hours before returning another guilty verdict, appealing the conviction again. In 2018, it was once again dismissed. This time, the courts did rule that the Crown's RNA evidence was inadmissible, which was the new, like, DNA evidence. Well, mm-hmm. RNA, but the new, like, scientific evidence. But insisted that no substantial miscarriage of justice had occurred.
Sure.
Mark did attempt to appeal to the Supreme Court and in 2019 was granted leave to do so. He was denied yet again when the court stated, quote, "The other evidence establishes beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Lundy murdered Christine and Amber Lundy," end quote. Mark continues to maintain his innocence, saying that while he respects the jury's opinion, there is no way that he could have committed these crimes, and he will continue to do everything he can until the truth comes out. So at this point, he's still in jail. His first parole date will actually come next year in 2022. And I guess we'll see what happens then.
Yikes.
Yes. So what I'm curious, what do you think about the way this case was handled? And do you have any thoughts on whether he may be innocent or guilty?
I mean, that would be a tight timeline. But I think if he did do it, it was an accomplice, obviously. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know that I'm set on whether or not he did it. Like, I don't know mm-hmm. that if I have an opinion on whether he's innocent or guilty, but I do feel like he should not have been convicted on the evidence that was presented at trial.
Oh yeah, 1,000%. That is not evidence. It's all, yeah. It's like hearsay.
Yeah. And honestly, the fact that the court was like, there wasn't this this scientific evidence was inadmissible, but it wasn't enough to be a miscarriage of justice, I think is bullshit.
Yeah.
Because I think juries are, even if they don't understand all of the scientific evidence, I think they're a little bit more susceptible to it because it is presented as like scientific fact.
Yeah. When a lot of times, a lot of things, you know, a lot of stuff that they're doing is experimental at first.
Yeah.
Which means that, you know, that shouldn't be used in a court of law unless mm-hmm. there is, what is it called? Like, you prove it. There's a history. There's a term for that.
Yeah.
So I definitely, but, you know, we're, it's interesting because there's a lot of things that draw similarities with other cases that are happening right now.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, a lot of people get stuck on, like, DNA evidence and autopsy evidence, and when they present scientists and in a court, when they give testimony, you know, it's they're reliable,
right?
Heavy quotes on that,
right?
I don't know. Sometimes I get a little weary that people are trying to solve all of these like cold cases with DNA evidence because it's like there's degradation, there's issues mm-hmm. of contamination, as you've demonstrated by the fact that they were putting things in paper bags. So it's like,
yeah.
Even if you have the method and it's tested and it's correct, there's still humans involved and there's still human error.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like, there's a lot of issues.
Yeah. I think at this point, like with my own understanding of the way forensics have progressed over the last like 20 years and science has progressed over the last like 20 years, I think some of this more scientific evidence is good. Like, it's good to have, but you need to, it cannot be the only thing mm-hmm. to tie somebody somewhere. Like, you have to be able to have multiple pieces of evidence to back it up.
Yeah.
And really like make that claim strong. And I don't, at least in this case, like the extra pieces of evidence that they had were not strong enough to back up that single. Because they also talk, too, a lot about this DNA transfer where it's entirely possible that Christine's DNA transferred onto the garment when she was, like, folding his clothes after she was doing yeah. laundry.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know, so I think there is a lot of question as to, like, if it wasn't Mark Lundy, who was it? But I definitely feel like he shouldn't have been convicted on the amount of evidence that was provided at trial
mm-hmm.
is where I'm at with this. This is a really, the Lundy murders, it's a really interesting case. It is a fucking rabbit hole. So if you have a spare couple of hours, I would say look into it because it can. I gave you guys, this is like the condensed version. Mm-hmm. So like, definitely take a look at it because there's a lot of like leads and stuff going on with this case. But that was the Lundy murders.
I wanted to look at a lesser known form of familicide. So I started looking at parricide, which, if you're not familiar, parricide is when a child kills their parents.
Yes.
So we don't cover like a whole lot of child killers. So I want to take a look at this phenomenon. And of course, like the first most well-known one that you can think about is the Menendez brothers, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
But the phenomenon of parricide isn't that common, which I find a little surprising, because I for sure thought it would be.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's, again, this is like something within the last like 2 or 3 years, I've seen a lot more cases of it happening.
Mm-hmm.
But like, even with the Menendez brothers, like, do you remember how old they were when that all
They
occurred?
Were teenagers.
Okay. Yeah, because it generally, it seems to be like teenage boys that will.
Yes. So looking at some of the statistics, they kind of looked at age groups, and most of the offenders do commit in their teen years, but they say that 1 in 5 cases of parricide is committed by someone under the age of 18.
Really?
So that is also kind of an interesting statistic.
Wow.
And then when they compare it across countries, the case that I looked at you know, stated the low levels in Australia and the UK, and then only 29 cases in 1 year in Canada. But still, like, 29 cases in 1 year in Canada.
It's a lot.
Seems like a lot.
Yeah.
More often than not, it is males, but there have been cases of women, girls, committing parricide. So the particular one I wanted to discuss is the Ewell family murders. So this is going to be a U.S. case, and specifically in California. So Dale Ewell and Glee Mitchell were a moderately well-off couple living on the bluffs of the San Joaquin River in California. Dale Ewell was an Air Force veteran turned businessman who specialized in the sale of small airplanes with his company, Western Piper Sales Incorporated. Now, this company effectively made Dale a millionaire, and his wife, Glee, was really devoted to philanthropy for her whole life. So she had a really interesting background, though. When she was young, she briefly acted as a Spanish translator for the CIA during the 50s. Ooh. And then later held a seat at the State Bar of California committee that evaluated prospective judges.
Okay, that would be interesting. So
they're very well connected. They're wealthy. The couple did have two kids. They were Tiffany Ewell in 1967, and then later their son Dana came in 1971. So very classic yuppie names, Tiffany and Dana.
Yeah.
In April of 1992... the family would change forever. So this was Easter weekend, and the family went about their, like, normal business. That Sunday, Dale, Glee, and Tiffany departed from their beach house to head home. Dale was on his way back from the trip, and he took his private plane back. He flew into the hangar and then drove home from there. Meanwhile, Glee and Tiffany drove home and arrived first, both in their vehicle. Now, little did they know that they were going to be walking into a trap. At home was Glee and her daughter, Tiffany. They get there. Tiffany was on a small break from grad school. She decided to spend time with her parents. But Dana actually decided to spend the holiday weekend with his girlfriend, Monica Zent, and her father, who just happened to be an FBI agent named John.
Oh my God.
They were in San Francisco, which is like 200 miles away. Tiffany was home with the parents. They come back. So upon entering, Glee and Tiffany came into the house in the afternoon, and they were met with a stranger. They were shot at rapid fire as soon as they came through the door. Tiffany was shot 6 times. She entered first, and Glee was shot 4. Half an hour later, Dale arrived home and entered through the garage. He, too, was met with bullets. He was shot only once in the back of the head. 2 days later, Dana contacted some family friends and stated that he was not able to get a hold of his parents. Now, this isn't unusual. The couple was always really busy with work. They'd often take off on short flights for fun. If you have a small plane, that's what you do.
Yeah.
But the family friends didn't really think anything odd, and nothing was done. Now, it's Tuesday, April 12th. Juanita Avenida arrived at the Ewell home. Juanita was the Ewell's longtime housekeeper. Upon entering the house through the kitchen, she came around to the front of the house to see pools of blood and the body of Tiffany, Glee, and Dale scattered on the floor. Now, the house had been ransacked and it was in shambles, and Juanita ran next door to the neighbors and they called the police, and soon they arrived. And she took them over to the house and she mentioned, like, the son was not there. He's missing. So there should be, you know, Dana's not here. He should be here. She did mention that he went on a trip with his girlfriend over Easter. So the police were like, all right, let's contact him and find out where he's at. So while they're trying to get a hold of Dana, they begin investigating the scene. Now, there was no immediate forensic evidence, but it did appear that the ransacking had been staged.
Okay.
There were no broken windows, no doors appeared to be forced, and the alarm was actually turned off.
Huh.
Nothing of value had been taken either.
So, was it like one of these where, like, somebody came in and just, like, threw a bunch of shit around?
Yeah.
Type of a deal?
That's what it appeared to be.
Okay.
Now, they found bullet casings and some green fibers around the bullet wound on Glee. This was pretty much all that they had. The police spent 4 days at the scene investigating and came to the conclusion that a person had been lying in wait in the home. They perhaps knew them or knew someone who knew them. That's how they got in. And they also brought a gun and used bullets that they found in the home.
Okay.
So a little strange. The police then turned to investigating the backgrounds of the Yules to see if anyone they knew might be of interest. Of course, Glee's time at the CIA was of interest.
Right.
Searching court records, detective learned another interesting fact, that Dale Yule had sold planes for aircraft dealer Frank Lambie. Now, Frank Lambie, in 1971, oversaw a large Mexico to Fresno drug smuggling ring.
Oh my gosh. I feel like the history of this family and their connections just keep getting more interesting.
Mm-hmm. Lambie was jailed and Yule took over the dealership. The investigators wanted to pursue this theory because they wanted to see if there was like bad blood between Lambie and the Yules. And they also speculated that Yule might have been involved in the drug smuggling ring. But after a lot of research and talking to people, they discovered that that wasn't the case. He was just getting in contact with Lambie, being in the right place at the right time, and was not actually involved in any of the drug smuggling. I do find this hard to believe because who owns a small plane and is not involved in some sort of nefarious activity?
Right.
No one. So as the sole survivor of the family, Dana was the beneficiary of their estate and also became the prime suspect. Even though he had an alibi, there was something suspicious about his behavior following the murders of his family.
Oh boy, investigators, here we go.
Yeah, investigators were like, something's not right with this boy. They noted that he was really shaken and visibly upset by their death, and they didn't think that that was not disingenuous. They were like, that seemed like he was legitimately upset.
Mm-hmm.
But he seemed far more concerned about the reading of his parents' will.
Of course.
Of course. We come back with the insurance and the wills.
It's always about the money.
Yeah, exactly. He immediately came back from his trip and then entered into the house and was living there.
Okay.
Now, the upsetting part about this is that it was still a crime scene, basically, and there was still blood everywhere. All up and down the walls.
Oh my god. So you didn't even wait for, like, the cleanup to finish?
No.
Wow.
So he also, upon coming home and staying there, invited people over to the home. And shortly after this, his uncle, which was Dale's brother, contacted authorities about his nephew. Now, his uncle claimed that upon the reading of the wills, Dana erupted in anger when he found out that the trust provisions of the will would keep him from actually having full access to their $8 million estate until he was 30.
Oh my god. And how old was he at the time?
I believe he was 23, 24.
Okay. So he had a little time. Bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He even shouted, "Why would my parents do this to me?"
Oh my god. Poor me.
Right? Now, the one stipulation of the will that was overlooked is that Dana would receive $300,000 in proceeds from an insurance policy that was not subject to trust provisions. So that was kind of overlooked. His parents probably didn't realize that that was the case.
Yeah.
Now, his uncle made every attempt to keep him from getting this money, but he was unsuccessful. There was nothing that they could do. So the police were really suspicious of this, and they decided to dive in and start following Dana and digging into his past. Now, this is where it gets really funny. Murder's funny, guys.
Oh, God.
This fucking twerp play-acted his way through college. Now, what I mean by this is that he pretended to be somebody else, basically.
What?
When he left home for the University of Santa Clara, he left and arrived at school with a BMW dressed in designer clothes. Okay? He attended classes with a suit on and carried a briefcase. Now, this was all an act because he had to live up to a persona that he had created. He told his classmates that he had been a stockbroker at 18 and currently owned a company that grossed nearly $3 million a year. But he's so humble that he started going to a small university in Santa Clara. Good story. Real good story, bro.
Yeah, that's a very, like, Zuckerbergian type of...
Yes.
I'm just so humble. I just wanted to go to a college where nobody knew me.
Exactly. So oh he's God. Doing all this stuff. There was even a fucking newspaper article in Santa Clara about this kid that was like, boy wonder genius attends university.
Did they still, like, was he still going by his real name?
Yeah, so he went by his real name. But he was, like, weaving the story, but there was no evidence. But people were, like, eating it up, and there was even a newspaper article ran about him. And nobody, like, thought to fact check this.
Oh, my God.
It was the 80s. Everyone was on cocaine. So
yeah.
He also had a really strange friendship with a man named Joel Radovich. Now, Radovich was this grungy skater boy and very introverted. And then in comparison, you have Dana, who's this, like, classic California guy who was, like, really outgoing, very, like, Southern Cali dude. But the two, like, met in college, and they were, like, absolutely joined at the hip. Shortly after the murders, however, Joel actually dropped out of school and moved into the Ewells' home with Dana.
Okay.
Both started making unusual cash purchases, like buying helicopter piloting lessons, extravagant clothes. There was, like,
oh God,
they bought a fucking watch, cars. Joel had no income, though, so this was really precarious. Dana even went forth and paid for his girlfriend Monica's tuition and bought her a car. Like, they were, like,
wow,
shelling out the money.
Okay.
Now, they both were interviewed and both said that they didn't really know each other and they weren't really friends, but they were fucking living together, so that didn't make any sense.
Yeah.
I don't think that they knew that the cops were really watching them. So the cops decided, okay, this is fucking weird. Like, we see that you live together. Hello. They decided that they were going to do all the surveillance and cue all the vans and wiretaps, because that's what was coming.
Because that's what they do.
Yes.
The police and the FBI and the government, they're always watching.
It. They always be tapping in. So police discovered that the two actually communicated mostly through pagers and payphones. Now, kids, I know what you probably don't know what a payphone is.
Oh, my
gosh. But it's a dial telephone that was stationed all over the city for someone to use with change. I am making a point to describe what a payphone is because I literally had this conversation with a teenager who did not know what a payphone was. So I got really
concerned.
Has
it really been long enough that, like, younger kid, like teenagers,
yeah,
were not born during the payphone
period. And if you don't
know
what a pager is, let me throw that in there. A pager was before cell phones, where you could call someone from a landline to their pager number. It would beep them, say, you need to call me. So, pre-phone. It is getting to that point. We are not even that old. The 90s were not even that far away, but no one knows what a fucking payphone is or a pager, so...
I feel
it's
like
fine.
If you don't know what a payphone is, you're definitely not going to know what a pager is.
Exactly. So.
Oh my God.
This is old lady corner.
Yeah.
Ugh. So they were communicating with payphones and pagers. They would page each other. They would go find the nearest payphone and call one another, which is smart. But also, you can totally wiretap a payphone. It's public.
Yeah.
Now, authorities had Dana's pager cloned. This is where it gets really weird. They had it cloned, and they wiretapped his landline. So when they clone a pager, what they do is every time that person gets paged, a duplicate message gets sent to the clone pager. So they
makes
can kind of see what's going on. In May of 1993, Joel was overheard by an officer speaking on a payphone saying, they don't have the evidence. They will try to catch you in a lie. Okay, suspicious, suspect. Joel's statement was obviously recorded. And then they realized that he had sent something else. They're just playing the game.
Okay.
So
something
all of
that
these
regular
things,
people say.
Right? All these things are coming together. They're using payphones and pagers. They're saying shit like, they'll catch you in a lie. Suspect. Now, after going through the insurance payout, Dana stole from his sick grandmother's account, taking $400,000, leaving her only $2,000 to pay for her nursing home care.
Oh my God, what a piece of shit.
Exactly. Unfortunately, he became her main caretaker and the, you know, beneficiary of her estate because she was basically an invalid.
Right.
Around this time, another friend approached the investigators with a tip. He stated that Joel had ordered some books and had them delivered to his house, and he had accidentally opened the packages, and inside was a book on how to be a hitman and another one on how to build a homemade silencer.
My God. Maybe he's just a hobbyist. We don't know.
Right. I mean, I had a copy of the Anarchist Cookbook when I was a youngin, and I never made a thing from it. I mean, the only thing that I make that is bomb is my cooking. Other than that.
Nice.
I am not making bombs. I make crockpots for cooking, not for bomb making. So they were like, oh, all right, I think we might have enough to get these fucking dummies. So the one thing, though, that was eluding them was the murder weapon. So they had to do a little bit extra investigating around that, but they were pretty much sure that they had the guys. They knew that the murder weapon was a specialty 9mm assault rifle that was manufactured in Colorado. Now, this is the olden times. This is the early 90s that they're having to do this investigation, and they had to go back through company records. Company records showed that one rifle had been purchased by Ernest Jack Ponce shortly before April of 1992. So they were like, we'll take a look. We'll see. Jack Ponce just so happened to be a high school friend of Joel Radovich.
Okay.
One question, Jack at first denied buying the gun and then tried to say that he purchased it for himself as a birthday gift and that Joel had never seen or known about the gun. And then he went on to say it was actually stolen.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. He's changing his story a lot. Now, around the same time that they found this evidence out, investigators visited Dana at his dorm because he had to go back to school. And they informed him that they believed that Joel Radovich had murdered his family. Now, upon hearing this, Dana said nothing, but the investigators noted that the color from his face was gone. He turned white as a ghost.
Oh my God. Okay.
Once the detectives left, of course, still not knowing that he was being watched or recorded, he rushed to a phone and called Radovich. On March 2nd, 1995, the police arrested Dana and Joel, along with Peter Radovich, who was Joel's brother, and Jack Ponce. Now, Peter would make a deal with authorities in exchange for immunity and testify at the trial against his brother and Dana. I'm not really sure 100% why they decided to include Peter Radovich. I know that he had received some stuff from Joel, and they were close, but in all of reading about this entire thing, I didn't really see what he had done or how he was involved enough to get thrown into this and arrested.
Yeah.
So that's a little confusing to me.
I'm sure if it's like something really minor too, like that's the person police are going to want to pinpoint to turn on everybody else, because it's easier to get rid of those charges if they're like a minor, you know, misdemeanor charge versus like murder, right? Mm-hmm. Like you can't really get somebody off on murder for flipping, but you could probably get somebody off on probation for like supplying a weapon and they'd be easier to flip.
Yeah. So he went on in his plea deal to tell the cops that he actually was the one to make the homemade silencer and that it was made out of a tennis ball and that he had welded it to the murder weapon. And that the gun barrel was disposed of, and the tennis shoes that Joel had been wearing during the commission of the murders was stashed away with a bunch of gun enthusiast magazines. So what wound up happening is they were actually finally able to deduce, upon him saying that the green fibers that were embedded into Glee's skin was that of a tennis ball.
Oh, okay.
Now, Jack that makes Ponce sense. Also flipped once he was arrested. He told them all about the gun. He admitted to buying it for Joel, but then denied knowing that that's what it was going to be used for. He also backed up Peter's statement that the two of them had disposed of evidence, so he had also disposed of evidence. He, too, was given immunity in exchange for his testimony. The barrel of the gun was later unearthed in a dirt field in Reseda. So they finally had the barrel of the gun. They finally figured out the silencer and why nobody had heard anything. So it was all coming together. But unfortunately, the trial didn't start until 1997.
Okay.
The presiding judge did not allow any television cameras into the courtroom, but did allow a local radio station to broadcast the proceeding. So you can actually listen to that if you'd like to.
Okay.
Now, Joel, in a stupid move, or maybe a brilliant one, I'm not really sure, decided to take the stand and tell the entire story.
Oh, my gosh. I didn't realize this was going to be a common theme today.
Yes. So, in a quote from an article, Joel, acting as the trigger man for Dana, who did not want to wait for his inheritance nor share it with his sister, entered the Ewell home with instructions from Dana. Having previously shaved his entire body, Joel waited for 12 hours sitting on a plastic sheet so as not to leave as much as an eyelash behind.
Oh my god, what?
Exactly.
So does this mean he took his eyelashes off too?
No, I think he shaved like his eyebrows and his arms and everything.
Oh my god.
So Tiffany entered first and was the first one to die. She walked by Joel unaware and he shot her in the back of the head first, but then proceeded to like shoot her a bunch of other times. I don't know. This obviously was the first time he ever shot anyone. she never saw him. Glee, however, did see him. And she, like, walked in and looked at him and was struck by a bullet and, like, literally bleeding, ran to escape from the door. But he caught up with her and just pumped bullets into her. He actually had her down on the floor and was standing above her, like, straddling her as he shot her repeatedly. Then he ran to the office and stayed there. Now, the fucked up part is that when they're talking about this, they talk about how she, like, looked him in the eye as he was shooting her, and it's just like, no thank you.
Wow, yeah.
According to his testimony, however, though, she knew who he was because she briefly had met him when Dana brought him home a month earlier. Now, after killing Glee, he changed the magazine and the gun, put on fresh gloves, and waited for Dale, which then he proceeded to kill immediately upon him entering the house through the garage door. So you can see, like, he pumped the sister full of bullets at first, like, kind of, like, nervously. Mm-hmm. And then he struck the mother, and she survived, so he had to go, like, full force blasting on her, too. But then when you get to the father, he was, like, knew what he was doing, calculated, shot him only at once, and was, like, done with it.
Yeah.
And you could see all the premeditation with the, like, shaving his body, sitting on a plastic sheet. Like, it was a lot of planning. On May 27th, 1998, 8 months after the start of the trial, they found Dana and Joel guilty on all accounts. The jurors were unable to come up with an agreement upon sentencing, so Joel was spared from death by 2 votes, and Dana was spared by only 1, and they are serving life sentences. Now, if you're interested, Dana was sent to the Corcoran State Prison and is on the prisoner's pen pal list. So you can write to him. He is he's a devout Christian and he's trying to, like, do the right thing kind of bullshit. So if you look at pictures of him, he has, like, a big fucking cross on and, like, geeky glasses, and he's, like, trying to, like, live the life by Jesus.
It's hard for me. I know I've said this before, but it is hard for me to feel like that is a legitimate effort. I know people can change, but, like, yeah. I'm sorry. Like, when you're in that situation, it's far less believable. And I'm sure he's probably like, people can believe what they want. I believe in God, so whatever.
Yeah. Joel Radovich was sent to the Mule Creek State Prison in Niona. Unfortunately, he still tries to get out. Dana has actually, like, accepted his life in jail and doesn't do anything to try to get out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Jack Ponce went on to become an attorney after being involved with this, so that's really great.
Interesting.
He continues to practice in Southern California. Joel's brother Paul now runs a company in LA, so they seem to be doing, like, fine, even though they were involved in a fucking murder. Interestingly enough, Dana's ex, Monica, also went on to become an attorney, and she also practices in her own law firm in Central California.
Oh, weird.
So, that is the story of the Ewell family murders.
Oh boy, that was pretty gruesome, man.
Yeah.
Well, if you're having a falling out with your family before you do something drastic, why don't you listen to this podcast?
Just become goth instead. It's so much easier. Just say gently, fuck you, mom and dad, and then we're all black and pout. It's very effective.
Hello, this is Margot P.
And this is Margot D. And we are the Margos.
We are the Margos, co-hosts of the Book Versus Movie podcast. We are the podcast that talks about films that are adapted from books. We read the book, we watch the movie, and then we decide which we like better, the book or the movie.
Now I know what you guys are going to say. Duh, the book is always better than the movie. To which we always reply, have you ever read Jaws?
Have you ever read Jaws? We are not film experts or literary geniuses.
Nope, we're just two friends who like to chat about books and movies.
We really like to go for a deep dive into the history of the book and the background of the author and the trivia from the movie set.
And most of all, we just like to have fun, so we never take ourselves or the books or movies too seriously.
You can find us wherever you sign up for your podcast under the name Book Versus Movie.
And on social media, you can find us at Book Versus and Movies. You just spell it all out.
Hope you check us out soon.
All right, guys, thanks for tuning into this episode. We've enjoyed being with you, but we also want to say thank you to the Elgin Fringe Festival and Side Street Studio Arts and the Blue Box Cafe for hosting us at the Elgin Fringe this year.
Mm-hmm. And our friends from Ghostly Podcast, who are in charge of all of the recording and everything.
Yeah, they were amazing.
Oh my God, they had such professional equipment. They were on their shit. They gave us the SD card, they're like, we got you. And I was like, well, we don't have us, but thank you.
Yeah, we were wildly unprepared, I feel like.
We're always unprepared.
Compared to them, yeah. But no, it was really great. We had a bunch of people come out. It was a good show. Had a good time.
A bunch of people, Vicky, we sold out, okay?
We did sell out.
we sold out the Blue Box Cafe. Put that on our resume.
Yes. So yeah, so thank you to everybody who came out. If you were able to come out, we are going to be releasing the Fringe Festival episode in a couple of weeks. So look forward to that. That's really exciting. Do we want to talk about Casting Whimsy?
Yeah, of course.
I saw some stuff going on our social media, so.
It's true. So in case you have been living under a rock, we are brand ambassadors currently for Casting Whimsy Tea Shop in Woodstock, Illinois. They are a fantastic mom and pop tea shop. They currently are in a very cute little location on the square, but they just announced a little while ago that they're going to be moving slightly off the square to a magnificent large building that should be open at the beginning of next year.
Ooh.
And they're going to have like a tea room. You'll be able to sit down. Currently, you can't do that in the space that they have now, but.
Oh, cool.
Until then, until they move into their long, big, luxurious new place. You can shop them online. You can shop them in their tiny tea store. You can check out all the amazing baked goods that they have. Oh, my God.
It all looks so tasty.
So many shortbread cookies, Vicky.
Are you complaining? Or?
No, I'm not. They have schmashmallows, which are their marshmallows that are homemade that are actually very delicious. I've made s'mores with them. They're really great. I've done a couple recipe videos, too, that are going to be kind of popping up on our social media with Casting Whimsy products that are just amazing and delicious, and you should try them at home. But yeah, they have such good stuff. And if you love tea like we do, it's like necessary for my life.
Yes.
You can actually get a discount from us to you, extended. You can get 10% off an order, and that's online or in person, either way. All you have to do, if you do it online, is to use BTC Pod. If you go in person, you just say, the Bad Taste Crime Podcast sent me. And they will give you a discount.
Yes.
And that's good for everything in their shop the first time you shop there with the code.
Yes.
But they ship to your house, and it's very quick, and it's amazing. And it comes in a really nice tin, because it's mostly loose leaf. It's secure and wonderful, but definitely check out their stuff. It's so good.
Yeah. So if you guys want to try some tea or some really delicious baked goods, you can find them at castingwhimsy.com. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Castingwhimsy.com, or you can go visit them on the square in Woodstock, Illinois. Yeah. Check them out. They got some really good looking stuff. So
yeah, they do farmers markets too. So you can check their social media to see if they're at a farmers market near you. They do travel around a bit. So
awesome. I think that's all we have for this week.
We do.
all of our big stuff is done, and mm-hmm. we're just trying to live it out to the end of the year.
Oh, God.
And
I feel like I'm not going to survive to 2022. Yeah.
We'll see. You know, we'll get there with the help of all of you.
Mm-hmm.
And so with that, we will say our sound and editing is by Tiff Fulman. Our music is by Jason Zachowski, the Enigma. This has been the Bad Taste Crime Podcast. We will see you in 2 weeks. Goodbye.
See ya. 10 young women had left their bodies on the hillsides along the highway. You have to see what happened. It was as if a wave of evil washed over this town.